if both parties involved were simply honest and forthright about their needs. Even when there's a disagreement, I've found people will respect you more for putting your cards on the table. Whether at the negotiating table or at the dinner table, our penchant for inhibition creates a psychological barrier that separates us from those we'd like to know better. When we leave a formal, hesitant, and uncomfortable conversation where we've held back our true selves, we console ourselves by dismissing the encounter, or more often, the person, by thinking, "We had nothing much in common anyway." But the truth is, everyone has something in common with every other person. And you won't find those similarities if you don't open up and expose your interests and concerns, allowing others to do likewise. This has some comforting implications. Once you know heartfelt candor is more effective than canned quips in starting a meaningful conversation, the idea of breaking the ice becomes easy. Too many of us believe breaking the ice means coming up with a brilliant, witty, or extravagantly insightful remark. But few among us are Jay Leno or David Letterman. When you realize the best icebreaker is a few words from the heart, the act of starting a conversation becomes far less daunting. Again and again, I'm surprised by the power of the vulnerability principle in the art of making small talk. Recently, I attended a conference board meeting, an annual gathering for executives in marketing and communications. As is the custom, participants gather for a dinner the night before the event. That night, sitting around the table were the heads of marketing for companies like Walmart, Cigna, Lockheed, Eli Lilly, eBay, and Nissan. All of them were people who managed significant marketing budgets. Their importance to my business was significant. This was an occasion that called for my being at my best. Problem was, I left my best somewhere over Pittsburgh on the flight there. The soundtrack of my life that night was The Blues. Hours before, I had received the final and definitive email that confirmed my worst fears. I was single again. I had just experienced the end of a traumatic and emotionally draining breakup. I was in no mood to talk. Sherry, the woman I was sitting beside, whom I had just met, had no idea I wasn't being myself. As the conversation raged on at the dinner table, I realized I was doing all the things I tell people never to do. I was hiding behind polite, inconsequential questions about nothing in particular. Here we were, Sherry and I, looking at each other and talking, but really saying nothing. It was clear we both couldn't wait for the check. At some point, I realized how absurd I was behaving. I've always told people I believe that every conversation you have is an invitation to risk revealing the real you. What's the worst that can happen? They don't respond in kind? So what? They probably weren't worth knowing in the first place. But if the risk pays off, well, now you've just turned a potentially dull exchange into something interesting or perhaps personally insightful. And more times than not, a real relationship is formed. It was at that point that I just came out and said what I was feeling. "You know, Sherry, I've got to apologize. We don't know each other very well, but I tend to be a whole lot more fun than I'm being this evening. It's been a tough day. I just had a board meeting where my board members put me through the ringer. More important, I just suffered a pretty difficult breakup, and it still got me down." Just like that, the rabbit was out of the hat. A risky opening, a flash of vulnerability, a moment of truth, and the dynamics of our conversation changed instantly. Sure, she could have felt uncomfortable with such a personal admission. Instead, it put her at ease. Oh, my, that's no problem. Trust me, I understand. Everybody goes through it. Let me tell you about my divorce. We became engaged in ways we hadn't expected. Sherry's shoulders relaxed. Her face loosened. She opened up. I felt drawn into the conversation for the first time that night. She went on to tell me about her painful divorce and all the things she had gone through in the months after it. All of a sudden, the discussion went into the emotional ramifications of breakups and how challenging they can be. For both of us, it turned out to be a cathartic moment. More than that, Sherry gave me some wonderful advice. What happened next surprised even me. Upon hearing our conversation, several normally buttoned-up members of the group stopped their conversation and were drawn to ours. The entire table bonded over the very common trials and tribulations of marriage and relationships. Men, women, gay, straight, it didn't matter. People who had been pensive and withdrawn were suddenly giving personal testimonies, while the rest of us joined in supportive stories of our own. By evening's end, we were laughing and talking intimately. It turned into one incredible dinner. For years after, I really looked forward to seeing my friends at this annual event. They're important people to me. Yes, some of them have become customers, but more of them are real friends I feel I can count on. Connectors Hall of Fame Profile. Brené Brown. Vulnerability is the birthplace of innovation, creativity, and change. Brené Brown, a qualitative researcher, studies the science of human connection. She was drawn to the field, she'll tell you, because data allows you to control and predict. Through data, she could make the seemingly messy world neat and forecastable. Safe. Or so she thought. A professor at the University of Houston's Graduate School of Social Work, Brown wanted to discover what separates those who feel connection and belonging from those who struggle to connect. What she found after 6 years of interviews with thousands of people was that the key to connect with others and finding meaning in life wasn't having everything under control. Until then, her own MO for managing her life and relationships. In fact, it was the opposite. It was being open to vulnerability, the dead opposite of control. In analyzing thousands of interviews, she found a pattern among those who felt worthy of belonging and connection, which she termed the wholehearted. What they had in common was what Brown refers to as courage. In the sense of the original definition of the word, to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart. They had the courage to be imperfect, to risk pain, and above all, to share themselves authentically. They believed that what made them vulnerable made them beautiful, she found. And not only was it the key to connecting, but also the key to innovation, creativity, and change, all of which require willingness to risk a step into the unknown. Vulnerability wasn't a weakness in business, as most had seemed to assume. In fact, it was the most surefire route to success. What followed her discovery was either a breakdown or a spiritual awakening, depending on whether you asked her or her new therapist. She spent a year struggling with embracing vulnerability in her own life and relationships, and learned a thing or two along the way. She shared those insights in a book called Daring Greatly, How the Courage to Be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. which Fast Company magazine called one of the top 10 business books of 2012. So how do we find our own courage? It starts with dispelling our myths about vulnerability. That vulnerability is a weakness, that we can opt out of it, that vulnerability is unfiltered self-disclosure, and that we can go it alone, she told Fast Company. She has also offered this poignant recommendation. Practice gratitude and joy in those moments of terror, and believe that we're enough. Because when we work from a place that says, I'm enough, then we stop screaming and start listening. Don't worry, you won't be alone if you try to take her advice. The talk where she gave it is among the top 10 most downloaded videos in the TED conference's history. The message here is that we go through life, particularly conferences and other professional gatherings, making shallow, run-of-the-mill conversation with strangers that remain strangers. Or we can put a little of ourselves, our real selves, on the line, give people a glimpse of our humanity, and create the opportunity for a deeper connection. We have a choice. These days, I rarely blanch at the chance to introduce topics of conversation that some consider off-limits. Spirituality, romance, politics. These are some of the issues that make life worth living. Of course, there are always fail-safe conversation starters suitable for every business function. How did you get started in your business? What do you enjoy most about your profession? Tell me about some of the challenges of your job. But safety, whether in conversation, business, or life, generally produces safe, read boring, results. The real winners, those with astounding careers, warm relationships, and unstoppable charisma, are those people who put it all out there and don't waste a bunch of time and energy trying to be something or someone they're not. Charm is simply a matter of being yourself. Your uniqueness is your power. We are all born with innate winning traits to be a masterful small talker. The best way to become good at small talk is not to talk small at all. That's the art. Here is some of the science. Learn the power of nonverbal cues. You're at a meeting when you turn to the person standing next to you. She turns to face you, and within a fraction of a second, your mind makes 1,000 computations. In that instant, you're trying to figure out whether you should run, fight, or be friendly. What you're doing, anthropologists say, is thinking like a caveman. Deep in our genetic code, we are conditioned to be afraid of strangers. Will they eat us or feed us? That's why we form first impressions so quickly. We have to decide whether or not it is safe to approach. You have about 10 seconds before a person decides, subconsciously, whether they like you or not. In that short period of time, we don't exchange a lot of words. Our judgment is mostly based on nonverbal communication. How do you get someone who doesn't know you to feel comfortable talking? This is not the time to play hard to get, keep a distance, or play mysterious. These all too common reactions may work for the likes of Marlon Brando, but for the rest of us, such poses register as keep away in our prehistoric minds. Instead, we should take the initiative in creating the impression we want to give. People are wowed by social decisiveness when it's offered with compassion and warmth. How another person perceives you is determined by a number of things you do before you utter your first word. First, give the person a hearty smile. It says, "I'm approachable." Maintain a good balance of eye contact. If you maintain an unblinking stare 100% of the time, that qualifies as leering. That's plain scary. If you keep eye contact less than 70% of the time, you'll seem disinterested and rude. Somewhere in between is the balance you're looking for. Unfold your arms and relax. Crossing your arms can make you appear defensive or closed. It also signals tension. Relax. People will pick up on your body language and react accordingly. Nod your head and lean in, but without invading the other person's space. You just want to show that you're engaged and interested. Learn to touch people. Touching is a powerful act. Most people convey their friendly intentions by shaking hands. Some go further by shaking with two hands. My favorite way to break through the distance between me and the person I'm trying to establish a bond with is to touch the other person's elbow. It conveys just the right amount of intimacy, and as such is a favorite of politicians. It's not too close to the chest, which we protect, but it's slightly more personal than a hand. Be sincere. Whether you spend 5 seconds or 5 hours with a new contact or acquaintance, make the time count. In Los Angeles, where I live, eye darters are a party staple. They're constantly looking to and fro in an attempt to ferret out the most important person in the room. Frankly, it's a disgusting habit, and one that's sure to put off those around you. The surest way to become special in others' eyes is to make them feel special. The correlate, of course, is equally true. Make people feel insignificant, and your significance to them shall certainly diminish. Develop conversational currency. When meeting someone new, be prepared to have something to say. Keep up with current events. Cultivate some niche interest, a single narrow specialty, cooking, golf, gardening, for which you have passion, will have surprising expansive powers. After business school, I indulged my passion for food and took a few months off, taking courses at Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School in London. Back then, I thought it was a frivolous expenditure of my time. But my knowledge and passion for cooking that came from that experience has come into play time and again in casual conversations. Even people who aren't that interested in food enjoy hearing my funny and sometimes embarrassing stories about learning my way around a French kitchen in London. What you talk about is ultimately less important than how. It's edifying and interesting to hear someone talk about something they have a great interest in, which means you can also talk about other people's passions. My COO at Yaya, James Clark, for example, climbed Mount Everest while performing his duties virtually for all but the week he was summiting. The astounding stories he told me about the experience are now excellent conversation fodder. Just remember not to monopolize the conversation or go into long-winded stories. Share your passion, but don't preach it. Adjust your Johari window. The Johari window is a model invented by two American psychologists that provides insight into how much people reveal of themselves. Some people are introverted, revealing little. They keep their window relatively closed. Other people are extroverted, revealing a great deal and keeping their windows open. These tendencies also fluctuate in different environments. In new and strange situations, with people we are unfamiliar with, our window remains small. We reveal little and expect others to do the same. If, on the other hand, the climate is safe and trusting with others that are similar to us, we share more of ourselves. Our windows open wider. Successful communication depends, according to the model, on the degree to which we can align ourselves and our windows to match those we interact with. Greg Seal, one of my earliest mentors who recruited me to Deloitte, brought this idea to my attention, and I'm forever grateful. As a brash, outspoken young guy, my window was wide open. Whether I was trying to sell consulting services to a shy CEO of an engineering company, or working with that company's rowdy sales staff, my brash, outspoken style remained constant. Back then, it wasn't clear to me why, for instance, the sales staff came out of the meeting with me jazzed, and the CEO couldn't wait for me to leave his office. When Greg introduced the idea of the Johari window and the need to adjust how open or closed that window was, depending on with whom you were speaking, it made perfect sense. Greg remained true to himself, no matter whom he spoke with, but he delivered his message in a tone and style that fit that person best. Every person's Johari window can be more or less open depending on the circumstances, and different professions, from those that demand a lot of interpersonal skills, like sales, to those that, like accounting, are generally more solitary, attract people whose windows share similar tendencies. A computer programmer's window, for example, may not open wide unless he or she is around peers. A strong marketing person's window, on the other hand, tends to be open regardless of the environment. The key is knowing that in conducting small talk, we should be aware of the different styles at play and adapt to the person we're talking with. I know I can be gregarious and fun and outspoken when meeting with the Farazi green light staff. In a meeting with, say, investment bankers who are typically hard-driving and analytical, I ratchet down the excitement and focus on being more deliberate and precise. If we address someone with the wrong style, the window may close shut with nothing revealed. No connection is made. Throughout my day, I come into contact with hundreds of different people, each with their own distinct communication style. The concept of the Johari window has helped me become conscious of my need to adapt my conversational approach to each person I want to connect with. One helpful technique I use is to try to envision myself as a mirror to the person with whom I'm speaking. What's the cadence of her speech? How loudly does she talk? What's her body language? By adjusting your behavior to mirror the person you are talking to, she'll automatically feel more comfortable. This doesn't mean, of course, that you should be disingenuous. Rather, it shows that you're particularly sensitive to other people's emotional temperaments. You're just tweaking your style to ensure that the windows remain wide open. Make a graceful exit. How do you conclude a conversation? During meetings and social gatherings, I'm often quite blunt. I'll mention something meaningful that was said in the course of our conversation and say, "There are so many wonderful people here tonight. I'd feel remiss if I didn't at least try and get to know a few more of them. Would you excuse me for a second?" People generally understand and appreciate the honesty. There's also always the drink option. I'll say, "I'm going to get another drink. Would you like one?" If they say no, I don't have an obligation to come back. If they say yes, I'll be sure to enter into another conversation on my way to the bar. When I return with a drink, I'll say, "I just ran into some people you should meet. Come on over." Until we meet again. In order to establish a lasting connection, small talk needs to end on an invitation to continue the relationship. Be complimentary and establish a verbal agreement to meet again, even if it's not business. "You really seem to know your wines. I've enjoyed tapping your wisdom. We should get together sometime to talk about wine." We can both bring one of our more interesting bottles. Learn to listen. As William James pointed out, the deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated. You should be governed by the idea that one should seek first to understand, then to be understood. We're often so worried about what we're going to say next that we don't hear what's being said to us now. There are a few ways to signal to your listener that you are interested and listening actively. Take the initiative and be the first person to say hello. This demonstrates confidence and immediately shows your interest in the other person. When the conversation starts, don't interrupt. Show empathy and understanding by nodding your head and involving your whole body in engaging the person you're talking with. Ask questions that demonstrate, sincerely, you believe the other person's opinion is particularly worth seeking out. Focus on his triumphs, laugh at his jokes, and always, always remember the other person's name. Nothing is sweeter to someone's ears than his own name. At the moment of introduction, I visually attach a person's name to his face. Seconds later, I'll repeat his name and make sure I got it, and then again periodically throughout the conversation. Give good chat. These days, like it or not, a good deal of our daily small talk is virtual, whether via email, virtual chats, or social updates. In my company's first New York office, we had the team packed into a room so small that they jokingly called it the sweatshop. When I visited, at first I thought it was the world's dullest workplace. Then one of them would laugh abruptly or shake her head, and I realized that there was a roaring stream of communication and collaboration flowing through their fingertips. In order to keep things quiet, they were using Skype to communicate, despite sitting almost shoulder to shoulder. And it was as natural and intimate to them as having a normal conversation. Adopt a casual conversational tone for virtual chat. Reading your lines out loud will help you get there. Do your best to correct typos as you go, but don't get so anal that it slows down communication. Take the extra moment to give a warm sign-off in an email. Keep virtual chat channels open during some part of the day. Have a joke handy. Find ways to inject some levity into the workflow, just enough to enhance productivity while not becoming a distraction to yourself and others. If all else fails, five words that never do. You're wonderful. Tell me more. Connectors Hall of Fame Profile. Dale Carnegie, 1888 to 1955. Learning to small talk is vital. The late Professor Thomas Harrell of Stanford's Graduate School of Business loved researching the traits of alumni. His chief finding, as you now know, is that successful graduates are social, communicative, and outgoing. Getting along skills, more than anything else, determined who got ahead. And that's why the legacy of Dale Carnegie, the first person to sell small talk as a corporate skill, remains intact nearly seven decades after the 1936 release of his bestseller, How to Win Friends and Influence People. For Carnegie, too, small talk became a means for self-advancement. Born in 1888, the son of a Missouri pig farmer who struggled all his life, Carnegie grew up ashamed of being poor. The feeling never quite wore off. And as a young man, he contemplated suicide. When he was 24 and struggling for subsistence in New York City, Carnegie offered to teach night classes in public speaking at the 125th Street YMCA. Fewer than 10 students attended his first class. For weeks, Carnegie shared with his students the skills he'd learned as a standout high school debater and as a student at Missouri State Teachers College. He taught people how to shirk shyness, boost self-confidence, and ease worry, using ideas that amount, then and now, to common sense. Remember people's names. Be a good listener. Don't criticize, condemn, or complain. After his first several classes, Carnegie ran out of stories to tell. So he asked his students to stand up and talk about their own experiences, and offered feedback on their performances. It was then that he realized that his students overcame their fear of taking the floor and became more comfortable talking openly about themselves, their self-confidence rose accordingly. In Carnegie's classes, businessmen, salesmen, and other professionals found a place devoted to affordable, commonsensical self-improvement. By 1916, Carnegie's course was so successful that he needed to train, for the first time, official Dale Carnegie course instructors. By 1920, Carnegie had published Public Speaking, an official text that he used to launch Carnegie courses in Boston, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. And it's possible none of it would have happened had not Carnegie encouraged his initial classes to open up and share their stories. It's no wonder Carnegie never failed to stress listening as a crucial networking skill. In an age when computers and email take the personal touch out of doing business, Carnegie's homespun logic remains as relevant as ever. People, after all, are still people, and who couldn't use a reminder of lessons like, become genuinely interested in other people. Be a good listener. Encourage others to talk about themselves. Let the other person do a great deal of the talking. Smile. Talk in terms of the other person's interests. Give honest and sincere appreciation. Though he successfully applied the fundamentals of smart small talking to his own life, Carnegie was reluctant at first to share his secrets in book form. The course cost $75, and Carnegie wasn't keen on giving away its content. But Leon Shimkin, an editor at Simon & Schuster, was a passionate graduate of Carnegie's classes. Shimkin finally convinced Carnegie, to the benefit of us all, to write a book. Perhaps by practicing the very sort of flattery and persistence that Mr. Carnegie himself advocated and admired, Mr. Shimkin won him over, wrote Edwin McDowell in the New York Times in 1986. For Shimkin and millions more like him, Carnegie emboldened us with the belief that we can learn to get along better with other people and achieve great success, no matter who we are or how poor we are. Section 3. Turning Connections into Compatriots. Chapter 18. Health, Wealth, and Children. What do you really want? Side by side, those five words may be the most universally resonant in the English language. As I discussed in the chapter, What's Your Mission? The answer to what do you really want determines all that you do and all the people who help you accomplish it. It provides the blueprint for all your efforts to reach out and connect with others. Likewise, when you understand someone else's mission, you hold the key to opening the door to what matters most to them. Knowing that will help you create deep, long-lasting bonds. In my initial conversation with someone I'm just getting to know, whether it's a new mentee or simply a new business contact, I try to find out what motivations drive that person. It often comes down to one of three things: making money, finding love, or changing the world. You laugh. Most people do when confronted with the reality of their deepest desires. Get comfortable with that reality. Learning to become a connector means, in some sense, learning to become an armchair therapist. As you continue down this path, you'll become a keen observer of the human psyche. You'll have to learn what makes people tick and how best to satisfy whatever tick that may be. It means calling something BS when you see people being less than honest with themselves. The most successful relationship builders are, indeed, a nifty amalgam of financial guru, sex therapist, and all-round do-gooder. Connecting is a philosophy of life, a worldview. Its guiding principle is that people, all people, every person you meet, is an opportunity to help and be helped. Why do I place so much importance on mutual dependence? For starters, because as a matter of necessity, we are all social beings. Our strength comes from what we do and know cumulatively. The fact is, no one gets ahead in this world without a lot of help. Eliminating things like intimidation and manipulation, there is only one way to get anybody to do anything. Do you know what it is? This is far from a trivial question. Business is, after all, the ability to motivate a group of individuals to move an idea from concept to reality, to take a theory and make it a practice, to gain the buy-in of your employees and colleagues, to encourage others to execute your plans. If you're still not sure what the answer is, take heart. Many people don't. There are hundreds of new books published each year grappling with how to engender loyalty and motivation. Most arrive at the wrong answer. They get it wrong because of the assumptions they make. It's in vogue for people to exclaim, "Everything is new. Everything is different. Business has changed." The answers, people suggest, must be found in technology, or new forms of leadership, or funky organizational theories. But is there anything really new or different about people? Not really. The principles of how to deal with other people are the ones Dale Carnegie espoused over 60 years ago that have proven to be universal and timeless. The only way to get people to do anything is to recognize their importance and thereby make them feel important. Every person's deepest lifelong desire is to be significant and to be recognized. What better way is there to show appreciation and to lavish praise on others than to take an interest in who they are and what their mission is? There is an added nuance to discovering what matters to people. Helping someone accomplish his or her deepest desires is critical, not only to forming a bond with someone, but to keeping that bond strong and growing. Loyalty may be the forgotten virtue of the modern age, but it remains the hallmark of any strong relationship, and a value many companies are working hard to bring into their day-to-day practices. Loyalty, to me, means staying true to someone or something, like a brand or a customer segment, through thick and thin. Loyalty is a marathon rather than a sprint. As any good brand manager knows, you don't win customer loyalty quickly. It has to be earned. How? Let me tell you a story about Michael Milken. Yes, the financial and deal-making guru, but also a man who is a philanthropist and deeply insightful human behaviorist. Through Entertainment Media Ventures, EMV, Mike was an investor in the startup company I joined after Starwood, and during my recruitment as CEO, I made it clear to him, and my friend Sandy Kleiman, who led EMV, that a big motivation of taking the job would be to learn from Mike while running the company. I had already gotten to know Mike independently a few years back while acting as an advisor to DuPont, when the company was starting a consumer soy milk joint venture. Mike was someone I had always wanted to meet, one of my early aspirational contacts. I had discovered through some articles I had read about him that he had a great deal of interest in soy and its curative effects. He had suffered a bout with prostate cancer, which he turned into a passion for health care and the importance of preventative medicine. To Mike, diet was an integral component in that mix, and it became a personal and philanthropic passion. From the beginning of my tenure as CEO, I sought to build the company and further my relationship with Mike. He, in turn, took me under his wing and opened his world to me. If he was going to New York for one of his many CapCure fundraisers, which support scientific research to find cures for prostate cancer, or traveling to some place to give out recognition and money to exceptional teachers through the Milken Family Foundation, I would try to catch a ride. My only goal was to watch how he worked and perhaps glean a few insights in the process. I made it a point to identify customers or prospects at whatever destination city he was going to, so it was time well spent for Yaya as well. Most of the time we would sit quietly working. He would plow through one of the 10 bags of reading he lugs with him wherever he goes, and I, of course, would be pounding away on my computer, emailing and connecting with abandon for Yaya revenue generation and business development. There was much to be learned in simply watching what he read and how he thought or reflected. On one trip in particular, Mike and I began to talk about people's passions, what really mattered to people. It was then that I received profound insight about people and loyalty. You see, Mike, in addition to having a brilliant quantitative mind, is also a relationship artist. I have seen him spend hours talking to people you'd never expect him to take an interest in. Secretaries, the very old, and the very young, the powerful, and the powerless. He loves people, their stories, and how they view the world. When I mentioned that to him, I was reminded of what Ralph Waldo Emerson once said. "Every man I meet is my superior in some way. In that I learn of him." Everyone had something to teach him. This focus on people was the reason so many of them showed so much loyalty to him. I feel that same loyalty. I asked how so many people became so invested in their relationship with him. What did he know that others didn't? Mike paused for a moment, as he does when he particularly likes or dislikes a question. Then he smiled. "Keith," he said, "there are three things in this world that engender deep emotional bonds between people. They are health, wealth, and children." There are a lot of things we can do for other people. Give good advice, help them wash their car, or help them move. But health, wealth, and children affect us in ways other acts of kindness do not. When you help someone through a health issue, positively impact someone's personal wealth, or take a sincere interest in their children, you engender life-bonding loyalty. Mike's experience was, in fact, backed by research. Psychologist Abraham Maslow created a theory outlining human beings' hierarchy of needs. We all have the same needs, Maslow believed, and our more basic needs must be satisfied before our higher needs can be addressed. The highest human need, said Maslow, is for self-actualization, the desire to become the best you can be. Dale Carnegie astutely recognized this. But Maslow argues we can't attend to our highest needs until we attend to those at the bottom of the pyramid, like the necessities of subsistence, security, and sex. It is within this lower group, where health, wealth, and children reside, that Mike was saying loyalty is created. In addressing those three fundamental issues, you accomplish two things. One, you help someone fulfill those needs they most need met. And two, you allow them the opportunity to move up the pyramid of needs to tackle some of their higher desires. I reflected on my own experience and found he was absolutely right. Recently, a friend of mine was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Because of my relationship with the CapCure Foundation, I knew the lead doctor there. I gave him a call to see if he could spend some time with my friend. Another friend, Mehmet Oz, who directs the Cardiovascular Institute at Columbia University and is a founder and director of the Complementary Medicine Program at New York Presbyterian Hospital, is always taking the calls of people I send his way. I know intimately how in a time of anxiety a reassuring expert is worth all the wealth in the world. Throughout my father's heart-related illness, a family friend named Arlene Treskovich, who worked for one of the best heart doctors in Pittsburgh, gave us access to medical advice few blue-collar Pittsburgh families can afford. She was just doing what she was taught. Her mother, Marge, had worked at the La Trobe Hospital and used to make sure that any member of our family or friends of our family who were hospitalized were treated like royalty, even if it was just an extra Jell-O from the kitchen when it was closed. To this day, I would do anything Arlene asked of me. Sometimes all it requires is taking an interest in providing emotional support. Let me give you an example. Robin Richards was the founding president of music portal MP3.com and built one of the highest-profile internet companies in the world. He skillfully navigated MP3.com through a very difficult period before selling it to Vivendi Universal, which subsequently hired him as a key executive. I met Robin around this time because he was leading a negotiation to buy our company. The deal ultimately fell through. But during the process, I learned Robin had a young child who had suffered from a terrible form of cancer. When he shared this deeply painful and private piece of information over dinner with me, the dynamics that so often attend a negotiation flew out the window. We discussed our shared experiences, and I introduced him to Mike, who was equally passionate about finding a cure for this form of cancer. Robin and I are still good friends to this day, and I know we would both bend over backward for the other. Have you helped someone lose weight by passing on a good diet? Have you found a particular vitamin or supplement that has helped you and passed it on to others? These may seem like little things, but with these three issues, health and diet included, the little things mean everything. When it came to wealth, I thought of the many men and women whom I've helped find jobs. While it's not the same as making someone millions through innovative financing instruments, as Mike had done for many people, a job significantly altered these friends' economic situation. If someone I know is looking for a job, I reach out through my network for leads. If they've already found a job they're interested in, I call the decision maker. Sometimes I'll simply help someone revise his or her resume or act as a reference. Whatever I can do. And I do the same for businesses. For the restaurants I frequent, for example, I make it my mission to send as much business their way as possible. I work hard to funnel customers to all my contacts who are consultants, vendors, and suppliers of all stripes. I know they are good. I trust them. And I want others to benefit from their expertise as well. People's children mean everything to them. I take it upon myself to mentor kids. It's fun, it's helpful, and teaching is the finest method I know for learning. The loyalty I've gained from placing a person's child in an internship, whether at my company or a friend's company, is immeasurable. Take my experience with Jack Valenti, the former chairman and chief executive officer of the Motion Picture Association, who passed away in 2007. Texas-born, Harvard-educated Valenti led several lives, a wartime bomber pilot, advertising agency founder, political consultant, White House special assistant, and movie industry leader. He knew everyone. More important, everyone who knew him had loads of respect for the man, in an industry not keen on doling out respect to anyone. Valenti had been an aspirational contact of mine for some time. I never sought him out, but he was somebody I knew would be very interesting, a hard-working Italian guy who worked his way up from nothing. I figured we had plenty in common. Our first encounter was pure serendipity. I attended a luncheon for cabinet members at the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles during President Clinton's last year of office. I spotted Jack among the attendees. When we all sat down for lunch, I made sure he and I were sitting next to each other. Our conversation that afternoon was good, entertaining, and polite. I had no mission or purpose. I hoped it might someday form the basis for something more substantive. Not long after, a friend called me, knowing I was passionate about mentoring. "You know, Jack Valenti's son is looking for work in your industry. You might want to meet with him and give him some advice." Jack's son is a very bright chip off the old block, both charming and smart. I gave him some advice, introduced him to some people within the industry that he should know, and that was it. Several months later, at the Yale CEO conference, I saw Jack again. "Jack," I said, "I'm sure you don't remember me. There's no reason you should. We sat together for lunch once at a Democratic convention, but I met with your son a few months ago to give him some career advice. I was wondering, how is he doing?" Jack dropped everything he was doing and couldn't have been more interested. He peppered me with questions about his son and what the best tack was to enter my industry. I followed up our encounter a day later with a dinner invitation, along with an array of political and entertainment honchos he could meet. "Sure, I'd love to come to dinner if my schedule allows," he told me. "But more important, I'd like to get together for lunch with you, me, and my son." Jack probably wasn't that interested in my dinner invitation. Who knows? But he was interested in the welfare of his son. Jack regarded my dinner invitations with a lot more excitement than he would have if I had not had the chance to give his son some simple and sound advice. Too many people think an invitation alone is enough to engender loyalty. Back in my days at Deloitte, and I see it today in my consulting practice, a lot of people felt that taking clients and prospects out to a fancy dinner, a ball game, or a show, was the way to build loyalty. I've fallen into that trap myself. In the beginning of a relationship, those kinds of outings are merely forums that allow you to connect strongly enough with the other person to help them address the issues that matter to them most. However, we've encouraged some of our biggest Fortune 100 clients to begin to invite their clients and prospects into their executives' homes to have dinner, meet the family, and understand how they can really help their clients as individuals. But remember, if you're going to deal with people's most important issues, give those issues the commitment that they deserve. If not, your best intentions will backfire, Hell hath no fury, like a person for whom you've promised the most intimate of help and delivered none. Can you walk the talk? It's easy for someone to say, I care about people. I believe in helping and being helped. I believe that helping people become healthy or make money or raise successful children is paramount in life. Many people say those things. But then you see their actions. You hear about them from their own networks. And you discover they really don't believe any of it. You can be sure your network will broadcast your true colors very quickly and with lasting effects to all its members. Where do you start? You start with the philosophy, the worldview, that every human is an opportunity to help and be helped. The rest, whether it means helping with someone's health, wealth, children, or any other unsatisfied desires, follows from that. Connector's Hall of Fame Profile. Adam Grant. There's something distinctive that happens when givers succeed. It spreads and cascades. Professor Adam Grant sees life as an opportunity to help people. And according to his own research at Wharton, that attitude is the very thing that has made him so successful, a budding celebrity in the field of organizational psychology. Helping others, Grant's studies show, motivates us to feel good about ourselves and work harder. The hours spent helping others actually make us more productive over time, not less. Grant stumbled onto the insight that giving, aka pro-social behavior, boosts performance when he was a lowly undergraduate ad salesman for the Let's Go Travel Guide series. I was a pushover, he says in his book Give and Take, losing revenues for the company and sacrificing my own commission. Then he had a conversation with a student who was paying her way through school with her job at Let's Go. Suddenly he saw his work selling ads not as a thankless grind, but as a chance to help. The more ads he sold, the more jobs Let's Go could support. Inspired by that idea, he became much more organized and aggressive as a salesman. Deals started stacking up. Within a year, he had sold the largest advertising package in the company's history. In the decades since, he's devoted a prolific research career towards studying the relationship between giving and success. Grant has found that people fall into one of three orientations. There are givers who seek opportunities to give to others without expectation of anything in return. Takers who hoard resources and look for ways others can serve them. And finally, matchers, who like to give as much as they get. But here's Grant's most important insight. The most successful people aren't just givers, but a particular subset. They are those who give freely, but also maintain a high degree of self-interest. They are strategic with their giving, and in the long run, it protects them from becoming doormats and washing out. Grant's explanation for how they do it provides a few useful crib notes to guide you in purposeful giving. Give to givers. Smart givers recognize takers and are cautious about giving to them, preferring to focus their efforts on those who might pay it forward. Feed your network first. They channel giving to bolster their social ties. In other words, they are aware of the need to nurture their own networks. Calendar time for giving. They consolidate their giving into chunks of energy and attention which increases their sense of gratification and allows them to protect other time for productive work on their own projects. On the face of it, Grant is a compulsive giver up until 11 p.m.